was not just the depression that derailed soccer, and it was not just the soccer war, but the combination of the two was too much.
That was soccer historian Roger Alloway, and this is Founding Football. Babe Ruth, Lou Gehrig, Murderers Row, Al Capone, Duke Ellington, Coco Chanel, F. Scott Fitzgerald, Albert Einstein, the Roaring Twenties, the Great Depression. I'm connected to all of these things because they happened and then they were documented, deemed important to the shaping of our culture, and were taught about them as defining characteristics of an entire era, defining characteristics of American history. They were then written in textbooks, added to a curriculum, and taught to me in a classroom at a young and very impressionable age. I don't remember exactly what age, but I'm thinking the first exposure to the 20s in history was around maybe sixth grade. I was measured on how much I knew about these people, and Prohibition, and flappers, and jazz. My ability to understand what happened in that era and why it was important, I was graded on that. Of course I'm connected to it. And there's an even deeper personal connection with Ruth, Gehrig, and those Yankees for me, because my grandfather was raised in New York. He was schooled at Stuyvesant, and he grew up a passionate fan of the Bronx Bombers. So the story goes, when he married my grandmother just before he went off to serve in the Army, their honeymoon was a Yankees game. Just one single Yankees game. It's not the honeymoon allure we think about now, but it was meaningful to them, and they always recounted it with a smile. Many, many times during my childhood. Even though I was raised in the suburbs of Philadelphia, these stories were part of my family history, my family identity. And since baseball was my first love, I was always exposed to the glory of Yankees history. Telling the stories of what was paints dreams in a way that shapes lives in the future. It's too bad that in so many ways we don't tell the stories of what almost was. Those are stories we should also write to inspire growth and change and evolution, but history doesn't document them and it doesn't popularize them. I've been in the northern suburbs of Philadelphia my whole life now. I'm significantly closer to Bethlehem, Pennsylvania than I am to the Bronx, yet there was no mention of the Bethlehem Steel in my upbringing. The Steel were the murderer's row of American soccer, the equivalent of those 1927 Yankees. Still considered the most successful top-level American soccer team of all time. There was no mention of Archie Stark. He's still considered the most successful goal scorer in the history of American soccer. In 10 American Soccer League seasons with the Steel, between 1921 and 1931, he scored 260 goals. This was the same time that Ruth was building his legend as well. Stark was doing the same thing, closer to my home, closer to my personal geographic history. But there were no soccer stories offered about Archie Stark when I was growing up. No attachment was given to me for soccer historically. There should be a personal connection there as well. My father and grandfather both went to Lehigh University, just minutes from the original home, what is arguably America's most storied soccer franchise. Maybe if we had known today's guest, soccer historian Roger Alloway, I'd have learned about the Steel. Maybe he'd have taught me about the soccer war and the incredible first golden age of American soccer that preceded it. I'd have understood the prologue, this prologue, in fact, to what has now been nearly a century-long journey for soccer becoming part of the American sports fabric. History simply doesn't teach that soccer was once popular in America. But that's exactly what happened before the soccer war killed it. Welcome to Founding Football. I'm your host, Kent Malmrose. This podcast is a year-long exploration of the critical events that have collectively made soccer popular in America. Today's episode is the Soccer War. before we spend a year talking about the moments that have one by one built back the popularity of the sport. And that's the plan, to cover one moment a week for a full year that has contributed to making soccer matter in this country. Before we do that, we need that almost history lesson. We need to talk about how we almost got it right the first time before losing it. And we'll get to that in a minute. Since this is our first episode, I want to set the stage. I want to clearly lay out the thesis and the intent of this project. You've probably picked up on it already, but let's really hash it out. Soccer is so often put in the proverbial corner of American sports, or at least it used to be, because now I would argue that it really has arrived. There's still a long way to go. American football is king. And maybe it always will be in this country. But soccer is growing fast and becoming a critical piece of our sports fabric. The data is simply inarguable. Between 1937 and 1972, according to Gallup polling, less than 0.5%, one half of 1% of Americans said that soccer was their favorite sport to watch. Even through December of 2004, after the 1994 World Cup, after the 1999 Women's World Cup, events that had huge impact in this country, the percentage never rose above 2%. But then during the excitement that surrounded the 2022 World Cup, polling told a different story. 8% of Americans named soccer as their favorite sport to watch in a Washington Post poll. Sounds like a small number, but that's nearly as many Americans citing soccer as basketball at 12%, or baseball at 11%. It was higher than motor racing, considered a prominent and dominant American sport. 31% of Americans say they are soccer fans on some level. And the ratings of that 22 World Cup were staggering as well. The final drew 26 million US viewers. That's more than the NBA Finals, more than the World Series, more than the Stanley Cup, and more than the Winter Olympics. Yeah, soccer has finally arrived in America, and it's definitely here to stay. Every week, we're exploring a key moment that contributed to soccer's growth in this country, helping explain the quiet build of momentum that's occurred over decades. I will miss some moments. You will disagree with some of the moments I've chosen, or my perspective, or my guest perspective on those moments. But I hope through this journey, we'll think about how history is all interconnected and how one event may be led to another, bringing soccer to prominence in America. I would argue soccer wasn't always the black sheep of the American sports family. There's precedent for what we're seeing now. It was growing in popularity late in the 1800s, then again with a little bit of lumpiness in the early 1900s, but with unquestionable gains in momentum into the 1920s. It was on track to be relevant, and then the soccer war destroyed it. In the simplest depiction of this event, it was like anything else, a struggle over power and money taking place between 1927 and 1929, but really starting much, much earlier. The American Soccer League, or ASL, was the most popular top-flight game in town. The league made money, it had ambitious owners, and it recruited top foreign players. And that was a problem, and it got the U.S. into hot water with FIFA, who had been established in 1904 to govern the global game. At that point, the U.S. had some international success. It wanted to stay on the map. The United States Football Association, or USFA, it negotiated with FIFA, agreed to punish the ASL, and the soccer war, it was on. 2 years of infighting played out, culminating in lost revenue, confusion, and ultimately a settlement that concluded 2 weeks before the stock market crashed in October of 1929. America was left without a clear soccer identity or any money to fund a rehabbed image. It was from that moment that I believe we've been trying to rebuild soccer in America. It's believed that soccer dates back to the Pilgrims' arrival in America. The first known soccer club, the Oneidas, was formed during the Civil War, specifically in 1862 in Boston, and by many accounts, the first recorded organized match of soccer in America was played on October 11th, 1866 in Wisconsin. 10 years later, The first intercollegiate matches took place, though other history credits the first college matches, maybe happening as early as 1869. Popularity accelerated in the decades that followed, fueled largely by immigration to the U.S. Immigrant communities and soccer. We're going to talk a lot about this throughout the season. The identity of soccer in America, for so much of its history, was based on immigrant communities embracing the game, and the challenge we as a country had bringing forward soccer to a collective identity. At the time, all parts of the country experienced this effect on soccer popularity. There were community centers and they had teams, and then it was magnified by industrialization because communities that had textile mills or shipyards or quarries or mines, they also had soccer teams financed by those companies. So you saw this pattern occurring all over the world during the time of the Industrial Revolution, but it was pronounced in America. A prime example of this was the West Hudson, New Jersey community of Kearney. It was inundated by the British factory workers who established their own successful team, and ultimately, the first concepts of a professionalized league in America were formed there. Similar teams formed and succeeded in Massachusetts and New York and Rhode Island and Pennsylvania. You see, organization, that's key. Organizing sports, creating teams, financing those teams, scheduling them to compete against each other so they could demonstrate physical dominance. These are human instincts. Governing bodies and consistent leagues, that's what helps grow sporting popularity. Organization helps grow anything. You don't need to look further than the history of labor unions in the U.S. to see how organizing drives growth and power. But particularly in sports, organizing is what showcases the best against the best. It creates the highest level of competition. It creates an opportunity to highlight great athletic achievements. And that's what began happening with soccer. It was organizing. In the case of soccer in America, early in the 20th century, this was an inflection point. The formation of multiple leagues and governing bodies simultaneously, and the inability of leadership to consolidate those leagues and governing bodies in the name of growth for the sport, that created confusion, it created conflict. That was what ultimately led to the soccer war. Like with any historical event, it was the culmination of many smaller moments leading up to one inflection point. World War I wasn't fought because Archduke Ferdinand was assassinated on June 28, 1914. It was fought because of decades of geopolitical tensions that built up before that moment. Those moments are critical to understanding why that assassination triggered World War I. So too is the Soccer War of 1929, defined by decades of soccer's political tensions before that culminating moment. If you're a soccer fan in the U.S., you've heard of FIFA. You've probably heard of the United States Soccer Federation. But have you heard of the AFA, the ALPBF, the AAFA, the ASL, or the ESL? Probably not. But baseball fans have heard of Major League Baseball, better known as MLB. It existed in the early 1900s, and it exists today. If soccer had figured out how to create one identifiable league and a clear governance structure, it too likely would have survived the Depression and grown throughout the 20th century. But from the very beginning, organizing soccer was rife with conflict and really, really bad timing. 1884 marked the formation of the American Football Association, or AFA. That was the country's first governing body in soccer, and this was a reaction to the rapid popularity growth of the game on the East Coast. It was based in Newark, New Jersey, so basically it was near Kearney, and the idea was to maintain uniformity in the rules around the clubs and games being played in the Mid-Atlantic region. They wanted to make it familiar to anyone watching the game in different places, so they all recognized it as the same thing. And quickly, teams in New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, and Massachusetts all played under AFA rules. The AFA also launched a competition. This was called the American Cup. As the first non-league cup in the country's history, it was likely intended to unify disparate league efforts to establish the highest quality of soccer within the country, and it got popular very quickly, and then was suspended for a few years because of economic and labor unrest before becoming successful again after 1906. That success, of course, brought competition in the form of yet another organization. Namely, in this case, the American Amateur Football Association, or AAFA, which was founded in 1911. Are you confused yet? Because I'm sure fans at the time were as well. And that's the point. It only got worse. So now you have the AFA, you have the AAFA, and while the US was trying to figure out who would rule the soccer world in this country, the rest of the world itself was falling in line with the International Association of Football, or FIFA. We mentioned FIFA. You've heard of FIFA. It was formed in 1904, and it was supported as the single authority for the game internationally in Europe, with numerous countries following and supporting and joining the organization. Well, the US wanted to be one of those countries. They wanted to be affiliated with the governing body in the world. There was only one problem. The AFA and the AAFA both applied in 1912, which I guess is technically two problems, but either way, FIFA rejected US membership, claiming, you guessed it, it can only support one governing body. As you can see, the war for America's soccer attention was already being fully fought in 1912 and would really only continue to get worse. Multiple fronts had soldiers dug in and manning the trenches. The next year, some members left the AFA and joined the AAFA, and it reorganized as the United States Football Association, or USFA. Problem solved, because on April 5th, 1913, that was enough for FIFA to grant the USFA provisional membership, which ultimately was converted to full-time status in 1914. I guess we're on the right track at that point, right? Sort of. The USFA used its newfound power to establish its own cup, one to challenge the American Cup, and they called it the National Challenge Cup. Quick but relevant side note here, this is the competition that would later become the Lamar Hunt US Open Cup, the very same event that, as I'm writing and recording this podcast, is the focus of discord again in the world of American soccer. The longest running soccer competition in the US as of 2023 has now been abandoned by Major League Soccer, MLS, the top professional league in the country. That's a longer conversation, but here we are again, over 100 years later, arguing about the implications of cup play and its impacts on the perception of American soccer. But for now, let's get back to 1914. The AFA wasn't gone, the American Cup wasn't gone. Now it just all existed, all of it, two organizations, two events, lots of teams, lots of leagues, and very, very little consistency. The fire was burning, and with access to international football through FIFA, gas was about to get thrown on it. Let's go back to Bethlehem. The Bethlehem Steel football team was born officially in 1907. The Steel played among the amateur ranks, competing with teams that included some from that West Hudson, New Jersey area of Kearney, and it was an amateur outfit until about 1914. How about that? Charles Schwab, the owner of the Bethlehem Steel Company, he must have seen an opportunity. Two governing bodies, two cups, now international opportunities, leagues all around the East Coast. There was money to be made through soccer on many fronts. And after all, Schwab was a businessman. He began importing players from Scotland and England, and despite bouncing around various leagues, he took to the road, playing in exhibitions in 1916 and 1917, Then in 1919, the Steel became the first American team to tour Sweden, playing the top teams in that country between 1913 and 1919. They won 162 of 171 games, a total record of 162-8-1, and they were the six-time winners of the American Cup. This is why many call the Steel the forefathers of American soccer. They were a big money operation, so it's no wonder they were the anchor of the American Soccer League, the ASL, formed in 1921. Like the Steel, the ASL was intended to be a big money operation. It's important to look at the ASL as a truly capitalist endeavor. It was not a league working in concert with the USFA to push forward the idea, the brand, the concept of American soccer. As outlined in Brian Phillips' fantastic Slate article from 2010, the ASL in some people's eyes truly put soccer on the cusp of becoming a major sport in America. And leveraging the model of the Steel, the wealthy owners poured money into both metropolitan and rural towns and teams alike. The common thread was available capital based on the booming U.S. economy, and that meant teams like the Boston Wonder Workers, the Brooklyn Wanderers, the New York Field Club, the Patterson Silk Sox, the New Bedford Whalers, and the Bridgeport Bears could draw top players from Europe on the promise of high wages. In some respects, the ASL was the first model of what is today's Premier League in England. It was this very advantage, at least in terms of building and producing a great product at home, that started to rapidly undermine it. Remember, soccer battles were already ongoing on domestic soil, and now other countries had a reason to send troops. The wage advantage, the recruiting tactics, that started to bluntly piss people off. The way that the ASL recruited and signed foreign players, it was out of bounds to international protocols as dictated by FIFA, who, as you'll recall, was affiliated with the USFA. And the ASL didn't have the best relationship with the governing body. In 1927, FIFA got involved in the ASL recruiting tactics. Teams had been signing players that were already contracted by other top European teams. And those European teams complained, and FIFA, they responded. The governing body then compelled the secretary of the ASL to appear before its Congress in Finland. The USFA president, Andrew Brown, he still was thinking about the good of the game in America. He made an emergency trip to that meeting to fend off any punishment that might be given to the U.S. on the basis of how the ASL was doing business. Imagine taking a boat across the Atlantic Ocean, traveling for at least a week, maybe several weeks if you encountered severe weather, just to fight on behalf of America's international soccer future. The trip worked. An agreement was found that saved the U.S. from being penalized, and I couldn't find much about what that agreement actually entailed. But the ASL took exception to the entire situation. They wanted no part of any restrictions. Presumably, those were levied around how they could recruit and contract international players. These were owners looking to make money through soccer ventures. They wanted to spend money the way they saw fit to make more money. And if they could assemble great teams at any cost, they would do that. Charles Schwab wasn't the only big-name owner affiliated with an AFL team. Charles Stoneham was also a larger-than-life figure tied to organized crime and the owner of the New York Giants of Major League Baseball. He now owned the New York Nationals of the ASL as well because the New York Giants name was taken when he got into the soccer game. He had influence, or he definitely wanted to, and he proposed a National Challenge Cup boycott, something the league had done in 1924 and 25, which actually led to their suspension. He suggested this in conjunction with expanding the ASL into the Midwest. Basically, Stoneham was proposing a land grab. The ASL would become the only game in American soccer. USFA and FIFA be damned. Much of the league agreed, but three of the most important teams didn't. The Bethlehem Steel, the New York Giants, the Newark Skeeters. They broke from the ASL's planned boycott and played in the Cup. This was pivotal. It retained both credibility and quality for the competition, which also meant revenue. An emboldened USFA leadership suspended the rest of the ASL teams. And this truly, this action, this was the soccer war. The USFA versus the ASL for control of US soccer. USFA won a major battle, but the fighting continued on multiple fronts. Taking the three renegade ASL teams into the fold, the USFA established what was called the Eastern Professional Soccer League. Some also just called it the Eastern Soccer League. It was the Steel, the Skeeters, the Giants, and a group of semi-professional teams. The ASL wasn't as good a product as the ASL, which continued throughout 1928-1929 season. But the reality is everything was broken. Without the support of the USFA or FIFA, and in particular, without the revenue and name brand recognition of the Steel and others, the ASL simply faltered. Political maneuvering and infighting continued between the organizations, but eventually the ASL conceded that it was time to give up the fight. The league had started the 1929-1930 season, but the soccer war was settled in October 1929, forcing play to stop. 2 weeks later, the stock market crashed. For all intents and purposes, soccer vanished from the mainstream. The ASL did continue to exist under the name the Atlantic Coast League. Then in 1933, it scaled down to a semi-pro league, and the ESL didn't succeed. The sport retreated back into the immigrant communities and out of the spotlight. Today's guest is soccer historian Roger Alloway,
a prominent soccer historian, one of the founding members of the Society of American Soccer History, better known as SASH, and an author of multiple books. Tell us a little bit about the work you've done, because I think it's incredible and I'm grateful that you're here. So thank you so much.
Well, the first book that I co-wrote with two people named Colin Joes and David Litterer. And that was called the Encyclopedia of American Soccer History. And it was just a one-volume encyclopedia of teams, people, events, whatnot in American soccer history, particularly 20th century, but going back into the 19th. And then with Colin, I co-authored one called United States Tackles the World Cup, about a game-by-game with short game stories and box scores of U.S. games, men and women in the World Cup over the years. And then in 2005, I wrote a book called Rangers, Rovers, and Spindles about the soccer history of Fall River, Massachusetts, and Kearney, New Jersey, which were the two of the three early hotbeds of American soccer, along with St. Louis. And then in the last book, which I wrote, which is getting to be a while ago now, 2009, was called Corner Offices and Corner Kicks, and it was about the somewhat parallel histories of the New York Cosmos of the 1980s and the Bethlehem Steel team of 60 years earlier.
I didn't realize you'd done a comparison of the Cosmos to the Bethlehem Steel. I want to talk about the soccer war because I think that's, in many respects, an inflection point that prevented soccer from becoming as popular as maybe it could have been throughout the 1900s in this country. But you mentioned Bethlehem Steel, you mentioned Kearney, you mentioned St. Louis, you mentioned these strongholds. I don't think most people realize just how popular soccer actually was in the late 1800s and early 1900s. And a lot of it was because of immigrant communities, well-funded teams. Talk a little bit about that, you know, specifically the Steel, how that type of team, the emergence of these very successful American teams with international tours, captured the imagination of Americans at the turn of the century.
The Bethlehem Steel team started as just an ordinary factory team, yeah, with you know, guys who worked in the factory during the day and practiced in the evening and stuff like that. And it eventually evolved into something bigger as they started bringing players over, particularly from Scotland. The Bethlehem Steel Corporation made tons of money during World War I, and the soccer team benefited from this. Toward the end of the war, Bethlehem Steel was the largest munitions manufacturer in the world. It had surpassed Krupp, and it became so again during World War II. So the fact that the Bethlehem Steel team was at its peak in the period of 1916 to 19
Do you think in many respects the rapid growth around these industrial teams and immigrant communities was actually a problem, even though it made it popular?
I think the centering of things around immigrant communities may have been a problem in the sense that the leaders of American soccer, and I'm particularly thinking of the NASL, thought they were going to get more support from the immigrant communities than they did get.
Interesting.
Because they didn't realize that immigrants in America were more interested in following the results of the teams they'd followed back home than they were following new teams here.
It's interesting. So I don't know if you listen to SiriusXM, and there's a soccer dedicated station. It's called SiriusFC, and Charlie Stolitano's on it. He was actually talking. I was on my way to a meeting this morning. He was talking about this very topic where you have to think about the moments that made soccer belong to America. And I think what you're reflecting is that we were almost grasping for them in the early 1900s, the teens and 20s, but the opposite happened, right? So dig back into the immigrant communities, dig back into, for example, what was going on with these industrial teams. They start bringing over foreign players. There wasn't ownership with kind of the growing melting pot community in America. It stayed fragmented in many respects.
A lot of the ownership or sponsorship somewhere in gray area in between of American soccer was through ethnic social clubs, which were not out to make a profit. And there was a lot through commercial sponsors who, the owners of the teams, they may have been out to make a profit, but there wasn't all that much profit to be made. It might have been long-term. Similar situation was happening at the same time with the very early NFL.
That's right.
And for example, when Art Rooney bought the Pittsburgh Steelers for $3,500, he wasn't expecting to become a multimillionaire.
Yeah. He did, but he wasn't expecting to. And now a multi-billionaire if you do the same thing. It's incredible.
Yeah. He spent the rest of his life denying the rumor that he'd bought the Steelers as a result of a good day at the track. $3,500 seems ridiculously small now.
So why do you think there was a difference in how, for example, baseball evolved into this unified major league or the NFL started to evolve? Because as you mentioned, they're all in their nascent stages, really. So, I mean, from your perspective as someone that studied this, where do you think things went wrong? And is this maybe a segue into the soccer war? Or do you think there were other things that preceded that?
Well, I think that talking about baseball and football, and in the case of football, it's really more college football than the NFL.
That's true, yeah.
Had the financial underpinnings with which to survive the Depression, and soccer did not. It was not just the Depression that derailed soccer, and it was not just the soccer war, but the combination of the two was too much.
Yeah.
The timing was very important. People who know vastly more about economics than I do may tell you that the stock market crash was inevitable.
Right.
It would have happened sooner or later.
Right.
But American soccer didn't feel the effects of the Depression right away or the stock market crash. And the Bethlehem Steel Corporation, it took a year or so before it really started being hit by loss of orders and whatnot. But on the strictly soccer level, a lot of the American Soccer League's revenue stream was gate receipts.
Yeah.
And one of the things that the Depression did was it caused people to stop optional spending.
Right.
And tickets to soccer games were definitely optional spending.
Yeah.
And so it, well, with an awful lot of things in American life were hit in a secondary way by the Depression. And soccer was hit in a secondary way.
Is it fair to think that almost at that time, you know, we talked about college football's growth and baseball's growth. If you had to make choices and you didn't necessarily know where to put your money, right? Which New York professional team or Massachusetts professional team you should be rooting for, but you knew that you could go to a Yankees game. Is it almost that simplistic to think that the consistency allowed for Americans to make choices where they put their entertainment dollars?
Yeah. Going to a soccer game was always a little bit more complicated. You couldn't just look in your morning newspaper and see what time the game started. Just because baseball had huge newspaper coverage and soccer didn't. Soccer had a lot more in the 20s, at least in New York and Philadelphia, and I can't say about Boston, but maybe there too. Much more than it had in the 1950s and early 60s. I've looked at a lot at the Enquirer on microfilm from back then, and they had, although more from a little bit later years, but a guy named Levi Wilcox covered soccer for the Enquirer for a long period and had regular stories. And then in the 1940s and 50s, there was George Butts. But it still was secondary to coverage of the big sports. And it just wasn't as easy to decide what you were going to do. The subway, I'm thinking in New York terms, the subway wasn't putting on special games to go to the soccer games the way they did with Yankees games.
So I love this. We're talking about such a mixed history, right, of soccer in this country. And I think, you know, the exploration of this entire project of mine is kind of how we've now gotten to the place where, by some standards, soccer is third or fourth most popular sport, growing. It clearly has a place in our history. And I'm curious if we think about the soccer war as almost a perfect combination of factors of what America was, right? Capitalism, you know, immigrant communities, factions that are competing essentially to create power. Everything comes to an end in a pretty obvious way within a year or so of the stock market crash in terms of clear leaders from a professional and governing body perspective. Where do you think soccer was left after the soccer war? Where do you think we went as a public with our understanding of a game that I really think was close to being in the mainstream?
Yeah, I'm not at all sure how close it was.
Okay, talk to me about that, because, well, you know, if you read some articles, people think it was pretty close.
In a few places, they were doing well, but
going in the right direction, but not yet close, is maybe what you're suggesting. Okay.
It's like attendances have the same sort of inflation as money. 10,000 crowd might not sound like much back then, but it was huge.
It's huge.
Then.
Yeah.
When I say 10,000, I'm thinking of attendance in places like Fall River and New Bedford, and it wasn't the same elsewhere. And I wouldn't go so far as to say that Fall River was a veneer the way the New York Cosmos were in the NASL in attendance terms, but it was in the same direction. Let me talk a little bit about a thread that I have wondered about.
Yeah, I'd love to hear.
Concerning the soccer war and the underpinnings of it.
Okay.
And this is something that I thought of briefly might be something to write a book about. And after a fairly short while, I came to the realization that most of what I was thinking of, I didn't have enough hard documentation of everything. I was mostly, and I didn't want to write a whole book about much just about my own
about
speculation.
Your own opinion? That would make you a very contemporary type journalist now.
Yeah, I guess so. At the start of the 19, but I thought of this sequence of events as a continuous thread, and whether it really was a continuous thread. At the start of the 1924-25 American Soccer League season, it expanded from 8 teams to 12. And a great amount of this expansion was fueled by importing players, particularly from Scotland. And importing players from Scotland was relatively easy because the wages there were so poor. Some of the players that were brought over were ones that had signed for the following season with their Scottish teams. And there was a lot of outcry over there about what they referred to as the American menace. But the Scots didn't have the power within FIFA to do anything about it. But then in the spring of 1926, the Hakoa team from Vienna made an American tour, which included an attendance of 46,000 at the Polo Grounds in New York, which was the largest attendance in American soccer for half a century. 8 or 10 of the Hakoa players decided to stay in America and jump their contracts, because Hakoa was an all-Jewish team. And when they were over here, the Hakoa players discovered that anti-Semitism was not as virulent in America as it was in Europe. And they decided they wanted to stay here. And the Austrian clubs got, and some Hungarian clubs too, got upset about the ASL poaching their players. And they protested to FIFA. And there was danger of the U.S. Football Association being expelled from FIFA until the president of the USFA, Andrew M. Brown, made an emergency trip to the FIFA Congress. And he talked them down from expelling the U.S., but with some sanctions, which involved ordering the ASL teams to stop doing this. And one of the ASL team owners was Charles Stoneham, who was also the owner of the New York Giants baseball team.
Incredibly prominent in all activities around the ASL, correct?
Mm-hmm. And he was the father of Horace Stoneham, who was the owner of the Giants at the time I became a baseball fan in the 1950s, and who moved the team to San Francisco. And Stoneham did not like the idea of American soccer having to bow down to European authorities. He wanted to see American soccer run more like baseball. And so in the summer of 1928, he made a series of proposals to the ASL, one of which was to withdraw its teams from the National Challenge Cup. It's the forerunner of the U.S. Open Cup. And the ASL accepted the proposals. One of the other proposals was that eventually there would be a Midwestern version of the ASL, and the two champions would meet for what would be the true championship of American soccer, and the National Challenge Cup could...
go away.
Yes, could go jump in a lake. And the ASL accepted the proposals, and the three teams which you referred to said, no, we're going to keep playing in the National Challenge Cup. Those were Bethlehem Steel and Newark Skeeters and...
New York Giants.
New York Giants, which was not Stoneham's team. When Stoneham bought into the ASL several years earlier, he would have loved to name his team, but that name was already taken. His team was the New York Nationals, although in, I think, 1931, when the New York Nationals dropped out of the ASL, he grabbed the name, but the league only lasted for another 10 months or so anyway. The ASL, except for these three teams, dropped out of the National Challenge Cup. Because those three teams refused to drop out of it, the ASL suspended them from the league. And then, because they had suspended those teams, the USFA suspended the ASL, and the soccer war was on.
And they became the Outlaw League.
Yeah, those three teams...
Not the three teams.
They did become the out... Yeah, the three teams played in a makeshift league that was put together by the U.S. Football Association with those three teams and a bunch of semi-pro teams from the New York area, which they... I don't know if stole is the right word, but it might be, from the Southern New York State Association, as a result of which the Southern New York State Association got mad, and so it took the ASL side in the dispute.
And prior to that, hadn't that organization applied for recognition by FIFA? And I mean, there was all sorts of cross-fighting.
There was, back in 1913, AFA applied for membership in... actually, it did, at another FIFA Congress, it didn't apply for membership itself. It just asked FIFA to go slow on granting recognition to its rivals. Anyway, the soccer war was on, and it lasted from the summer of 28 until the second week of October in 29, and they settled it. And then 2 weeks later, the stock market crash, and in the end, that was the end of the ASL. And whether the My guess would be that the ASL could have survived the soccer war if the stock market crash hadn't happened. And it could have survived the stock market crash if the soccer war hadn't happened. But since both happened, the double whammy was too much for it.
And that's the topic of the book you want to explore, is what you're suggesting.
Well, the topic of the book I was thinking about was really more the chain of events starting in 1924.
Well, it's funny you say that, because as I was writing my notes for this episode and doing my research, people call that basically year when all of those events happen, the soccer war. But like any great war, the origin of it can be seen decades earlier with this cascading series of moments. And I do think that these different conflicts around governing bodies, as you mentioned, sort of touring teams, the idea of bringing foreign players into the U.S. There's all of these moments that lead up to the soccer war. But I do think it's fair to say, you know, if you were able to get your hands on, you know, the financial statements, for example, I think there's a lot of speculation that probably it could have survived without the stock market crash, but it was a longer term business speculation. The profits weren't there day one, but there was a debt position taken with the expectation that as they grew and they had more gate receipts, they would start to make money. So it was just perfect culmination of events in many respects.
Two other events that may have contributed to the downfall of American soccer in the wake of the soccer war and the stock market crash had to do with the departures of soccer from two particularly prominent individuals. One is Thomas W. Cahill, and he's the man who I think of as by far the most prominent administrator in pre-World War II American soccer. He dropped out as a result of the infighting within the U.S. Football Association. Dropped out. The final straw was when he was not appointed team manager for the U.S. team at the 28 Olympics or the 1930 World Cup. And his number one ally on his side of the infighting was a man at Bethlehem Steel named Edgar Lewis. I call him Edgar Lewis because I think that's what he was called most often back then. The Soccer Hall of Fame calls him H. Edgar Lewis, and some other people call him H.E. Lewis, but I call him Edgar Lewis. And he left Bethlehem Steel in I believe February of 1930, and the reasons why he left had very little, if anything, to do with soccer. They had to do with infighting within the corporation and the fact that it came down to a battle between him. He was the executive vice president, and the president was a guy named Eugene Grace, and Grace won the battle, and Lewis went off to Ohio to lick his wounds.
That's probably also a direct correlation to the Depression, you'd think, right? I'm sure the company might have
been
was
a factor
struggling.
In it, yes.
Had to be.
But the main thing was one corporation and two men who wanted to be running the show, and there wasn't room for, and they were also diametrically opposed in their views on a lot of subjects, particularly on the subject of labor. Lewis was a guy who would come to Bethlehem Steel in 1904 as an accountant, and was very sympathetic with the people in the mills. In fact, he had started at Carnegie Steel in Pittsburgh in 1999 as a tool dresser a guy who worked on the tools that were used for cutting steel, and he was known as an up from the mill steel man, and he was very conciliatory toward labor, and grace breathed fire toward labor, and they were absolutely opposed on a lot of issues.
As someone that knows this history better than probably anybody, right, in terms of American soccer, and I know you probably would say there are other members of SASH who have similar understandings of the history, how do you look at the growth of the game just more broadly over the last few decades? Do you feel like we're in a good place? Do you take kind of pride in how soccer has emerged? I'm curious kind of what your current perspective is on how the game is viewed.
I think from a league standpoint, I think we're in a much better place than I would have guessed 30 years ago. Yeah. I've rooted harder for the U.S. national soccer team, both men and women, but particularly the men, than I have for any other team in any sport in my lifetime. And back in the late 90s, if you had asked me to guess where the U.S. men's national team was going to be in 2023, I would have guessed that it was going to be farther ahead than it is.
I appreciate the time you've given, and I want to be respectful and wrap up. I guess, you know, do you have specific things that you think American soccer fans who are trying to understand the history should really know and understand about that period around the soccer war that we haven't covered? I mean, you did a great job, I think, extrapolating and connecting to kind of the broader climate, but a lot going on at that point in time.
I think the thing that they should know that I get the impression of an awful lot don't is simply that it existed. American soccer didn't begin in 1994 or in 1975 or in 1950 or even in 1913. And I think there are a lot of Americans out there, and of course with the kids, you can't blame them because they haven't had the opportunity to learn. But there are a lot of American soccer fans who have no idea that American soccer even existed in 1913.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think that is the key for me, is trying to even personally go through this journey of understanding the moments that got us here. And it's certainly going to be unique to what we are as Americans, right? Our own history, the ownership we have of this game, the ownership that we came to through exposure to the game globally, the ability to create critical moments, both cultural and on the field. I mean, you think about, obviously, the 99ers with the women, the 94 team, Lana Donovan's 2010 goal, you know, Clint Dempsey's goal against Juventus as part of Fulham. There's all of these moments that started to open this door up. But one of the reasons I did so much want to start with this era is because I don't think people know it exists. I didn't. It's incredible. I am grateful that you spent this time with me. Thank you so much, Roger.
Okay.
So Roger Alloway, soccer historian, founding member of SASH, which we've referenced a few times. As I say goodbye, I will agree with you. I just want people to know about this era, so I appreciate that you give me some time.
Okay, thank you.
If you look up U.S. soccer history, various sources make it seem like nothing happened between the soccer war and 1967 until the North American Soccer League formed.
That's unfair. Important moments happened before 1967. We will cover some of them. But the idea that soccer went silent, well, that's not hyperbole. While baseball and football and other professional sports grew, soccer faltered. Like so many wars, the soccer war left destruction that required rebuilding. Infrastructure was damaged, culture was lost, identities were changed. The soccer war simply extinguished something that had been built over decades. The soccer war destroyed a nation, multiple collective cultures, that had created something Americans almost embraced. History that almost was. Thank you for joining the first episode of Founding Football, The Soccer War. I'm your host, Kent Malmros. This episode featured original music by Hayden Malmros. If you liked what you heard, leave a rating or review and recommend the show to friends and family. For more information, visit our website at foundingfootball.com or follow us on social media, Instagram, Founding Football, X, Founding Football, and you can see video snippets of featured interviews. We'll be back next week with Chapter 1, the 1950 World Cup game between the U.S. men's national team and England. We'll see you then.